My name is Peter Mohan. I served in Afghanistan with the 82nd Airborne Division, and I served in Iraq with the North Carolina National Guard.
My name is Anna Mohan. I'm married to Peter Mohan. He's suffering now from post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's been very difficult.
We met at a friend of mine's wedding.
I'm sitting on the bride's side of the aisle, and he's sitting on the groom's side of the aisle, and he was this big, huge guy, and his face was all red, and he was crying during the vows.
Oh, yeah, I thought she was beautiful, and I was surprised that Anna wanted to talk to me.
Peter was fun, loud, gregarious around other army guys. Alone, he was very sensitive, very sweet.
You know, I was a typical, 22-year-old guy in the army. I like to go out and I like to party real hard and I like to shoot guns and I like to jump out of planes, you know?
I had never been into the army type, but I fell in love with him very quickly. And we went down to the courthouse and got married just 2 days after we got the call that he was going to Iraq. We were both scared. We were both worried he wouldn't come home. In his letters, he seemed like, towards the beginning, especially before June 24th, between the big battle, that he was more sort of like, okay, we're here to help the Iraqi people, we can do this, you know, there are good reasons that we're here.
June 24th, 2004. It was the heaviest day of ground fighting since the Mission Accomplished banner was flown in front of, behind our president. It was a bad day. I lost a close friend of mine, and our commanding officer, our company commander, got killed that day.
After that day, his letters started to question more and more. What are we doing here? Why did my buddy die? Why did my commander die?
You know, you have ceremonies for people. You know, when people get killed, you might actually have tears well up a little bit. You know, and then you laugh with your buddies later. Shit, you know, I almost cried. You know, I almost cried there. You know. When you're in a place where death is around every corner, you have to kind of callous your emotions and kind of disconnect. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be able to do it.
The day that they got back and were to be released, they had to fill out a checklist saying, do you have any of these symptoms? Do you have nightmares? Do you have thoughts of hurting other people?
Are you having trouble sleeping? Are you feeling suicidal? Are you feeling homicidal? Are you, and it's yes or no. So, naturally, when you get home, you just want to go, you know, you want to go back to the house and get all this crap behind you. So you just run down the no side and you just check them all no.
Well, at first, it was wonderful. He was home. He was good. We were excited. It quickly became apparent, though, that something was going on. After the first week or two, he was very emotionally distant. And he was spending most of the day at home, doing nothing.
I didn't want to leave the house. I hated driving. I didn't like being out in public. I checked the locks 4 or 5 times and checked the perimeter of the house inside, and always kept the blinds closed. I was doing things that you do to stay alive in a combat zone. And I was also drinking very heavily as a means to control my anxiety.
He was trying to get out of going out and enjoying life, going to the movies or going out, but I didn't really recognize that yet.
I was doing a good job faking. I call it a front of functionality. When I was really falling apart, I just kept doing the day-to-day things that, you know, have to get done in order for somebody to be well. Doing the laundry, washing the dishes, cooking, cleaning.
Weird things were going on, like bills were missing, where all of a sudden a credit card bill would show up and it would be 2 months overdue, and I thought my memory was getting awful. But it turned out that he was actually compulsively hiding them.
It was simple things that I just eventually I just couldn't do. Couldn't write a check. Couldn't make a phone call. And I didn't know why.
Eventually, I dragged him to the local vet center. I said, you have to do it. You have to do it. I'm going crazy. We have to go see someone. So they made an appointment for him at the VA clinic. And of course, he didn't make it to the appointment. He rescheduled it, but didn't make it to that either.
In a lot of ways, I was afraid of, you know, stigma of saying I've got post-traumatic stress disorder. And I felt like it was kind of a weakness. You know, as it turns out, I kind of realized it takes more courage to admit that you've got a problem.
I came home one day from work, and Peter was so drunk that he could barely stand up. And at the time, he was actually suicidal. He said he would go out on his motorcycle and speed as fast as it could go, hoping that a cop would pull him over and that somehow he could get the cop to shoot him.
Riding around, you know, at 100-plus miles an hour, putting my feet up on the handlebars, standing up on the seat, things that a normal person would not do.
He couldn't be left alone. First, I just took sick days, but eventually I took a leave of absence. We couldn't afford our house. Everything was falling apart. So my parents offered that we could come up here and move in with them.
Oh, I felt like a failure, you know. Like, geez, how can I have let things go this far out of control? I just recently completed a 24-day program, inpatient, at the Northampton VA for post-traumatic stress. You have group therapy sessions. There are a lot of classes about what PTSD is, what causes it. They teach you how to sort of step back in your mind and not get wrapped up in the thoughts and living these thoughts, kind of get to control your life and behavior.
I find it all very frightening and overwhelming because it's hard to figure out what their plan is at the VA. I keep thinking if Peter had cancer, then we would sit down with the oncologist and he would say, okay, you know, this is the prognosis. These are the therapies that I think would work best for Peter in his condition. But there's nothing like that. And I'd like to be more involved. I'd like to know what I'm supposed to do. Am I supposed to get him out of that room when he goes in there? Am I supposed to say, come on, you have to go out. We need to go do things. Or am I supposed to let him be? Am I supposed to say, okay, he needs to be alone right now? Nobody seems to be able to answer that question for me.
I believe it is hard for her, you know. I'm getting all this help and support, and she's standing by me, and you know, yet she still has her own issues and concerns, and I feel almost like she's putting her life on the back burner while I'm recovering from this.
And everyone keeps saying, okay, Anna, you have to keep moving on with your life, you have to keep doing things, which is sort of frustrating. So, okay, well, I'd like to go to graduate school, but right now that's not really possible. Okay, I'd like to go get a full-time job. Well, what happens if Peter comes home and has a really hard time and need someone to be with him? I have gone a couple times with him to his therapist. I have not seen my own therapist, and I definitely should. When we moved up here and I left my job, I lost my health insurance. So I have started trying to sort of ask around to find out if there are any, you know, good sliding scale therapists or, you know, someone who would do pro bono work. There is a spouse group down at the vet center in Springfield and a support group. And I went there a couple times, but the wives were mostly Vietnam or wives of Vietnam veterans. And I found it very difficult. It's very scary to think these people are still going through this 20 years down the road. And is this what's going to happen to us?
This is probably the worst thing that we're going to have to face in our lives together. And so far we're doing it, which is encouraging.
Sometimes I can still see underneath the person that I married. I do still believe that he has a beautiful, strong soul filled with love and compassion. But he's very, very different, and it's very hard to be emotionally intimate with each other right now. And I'm praying and hoping that once we get farther in the healing, more of him will start to reemerge.
I'm definitely not the same as I was. But despite all the physiological and emotional and all these things that have changed, I think at the core, I'm still who I am.
There's this sort of inside gut reaction that says, don't talk about this. This is private. And because of that, people don't really know the full extent of what happens after war. We really need to take into account everything that we're asking of these soldiers and of their families. And it's not just that they're going to put their lives on the line, and it's not just asking them to kill, but we're also asking them to put their emotional health on the line, possibly for the rest of their lives. And if we do ask it, it needs to be for a really good reason.